You're listening to the Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network.
In the future, none of you are heroes.
You're legends.
Get driven. Stay driven.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Bareback Facts, History, and Blood. Today we're going to be covering the legend of Gog Magog. Before we get started, guys, I just want to remind you all that we have a call-in number 718-508-9883. If you haven't already, follow my page on Facebook. It's the same name as the show, Bareback Facts, the History, and Blood. For those of you who are first-time listeners, or if you're just tuning in today just because, I also am an aspiring young author and have written 5 collections of poetry. My most recent one is now available on Amazon, and it is called Iscariot Song. It's dedicated to love in all its forms. Guys, today we're going to be diving into a nice little British legend called The Legend of Gog Magog, but it's one that has some very, very old roots. So we'll get right into what Gog Magog is, and then we'll dive into the roots of this story. It is. First off, I want to give everybody an idea of what Gog Magog is. Gog Magog, for all intents and purposes, is a so what is a giant? Well, giants are beings of a humanoid appearance that happen to be prodigious in size, which for those of you who don't like big words means quite large, and possess supernatural strength and endurance, surpassing that of a normal human being. Now, they appear in stories and from all over the world in various cultures and feature very prominently in many stories as either helpers to heroes or obstacles. So, without further ado, let's talk about Gog Magog. Now, he is a legendary giant in Welsh and later on English folklore, and features prominently in the work of Geoffrey of Monmouth's Historia Regum Britanniae, which is the history of the kings of Britain, which wrote the 12th century. He was a giant inhabitant of Albion, which we'll get to as well, and was thrown off a cliff during a wrestling match with the hero Corineus, a companion of Brutus of Troy. Now, Gog Magog was the last of the giants found by Brutus and his men inhabiting the land of Albion. The effigies of Gog Magog and Corineus, used in English pageantry and later instituted as guardian statues at Guildhall in London, eventually earned the familiar names Gog and Magog. Now, let's get into the story written, the Historia Regum Britanniae. Gog Magog, as I mentioned, is a giant of Albion. So what is Albion? First off, that's very important. Albion is the oldest known name of the island of Great Britain, and today it is still sometimes used poetically to refer to the island. It's the name for Scotland in the Celtic languages. The name for Scotland in the Celtic languages is related to Albion, Alba in Scottish Gaelic, Albane, genitive Albin in Irish, Nalbin in Manx, and Albin in Welsh, Cornish, and Breton. These names are later Latinized as Albania and Anglicized as Albany, which were once alternative names for Scotland. Now, these names are also used to refer to a mystical land, the Land of Giants. Now, a legend exists in various forms that giants were either the original inhabitants or the founders of the name called Albion. Now, according to the work of Geoffrey of Monmouth, his Historia Regum Britanniae, Troy, who was one of the first adventurers to Britain, was told by the goddess Diana this. Brutus, there lies beyond the Gallic bounds an island which the western sea surrounds. By giants once possessed, now few remain to bar thy entrance or obstruct thy reign. To reach that happy shore, thy sails employ. Their fate decrees to raise a second Troy, and found an empire in thy royal line, which time shall ne'er destroy nor bounds confine. Now, this, of course, refers to the Odyssey and the Iliad as well. Now, Brutus is a hero written in by Geoffrey of Monmouth, and he is a survivor of the Trojan War. And he, of course, is going to escape. After many adventures, he and his fellow Trojans will escape from Gaul and set sail with a fair wind towards the Promised Island. The island was then called Albion and inhabited by none but a few giants. Notwithstanding this, the pleasant situation of the places, the plenty of rivers abounding with fish, and the engaging prospect of its woods made Brutus and his company very desirous to fix their habitation in it. After dividing up the island between themselves, at last Brutus called the island after his own name, Britain, and his companions, Britons. By these means, he desired to perpetuate the memory of his name. Geoffrey goes on to recount how the last of the giants are defeated, the largest one, known as Gogamagot, or Gogmagog, is flung over a cliff by the hero Corineus. So Gogmagog is this last giant in Albion. Hope you guys are trekking with me thus far. Now, according to this story, Gogmagog's combat with Corineus is one that's supposed to have been a challenge laid down to get him out. Now, who is Corineus? Before we continue any further, it's important that we know all the players in our story, right? So we know who Brutus is, Brutus of Troy. He's a surviving Trojan and the legendary founder of Britain. But Corineus, who is he? Corineus is a legendary hero of Cornwall. And according to Geoffrey of Monmouth's work, he was a Trojan warrior who accompanied Brutus and killed the greatest of all the giants who lived in Cornwall, named Gogmagog. He threw him off a cliff near Totnes Devon, and it is still to this day called Giant's Leap. So Corineus earns his name in this story. Now, we need to know a little bit. Now, what can we tell ourselves more about Gogmagog? Why is this story important? Well, Gogmagog is now seen as a guardian. It didn't start out that way, right? He was thrown off a cliff by this hero Corineus. Now, the Historia details the encounter as follows. Gogmagog, accompanied by 20 of his fellow giants, attacked the Trojan settlement and caused great slaughter. So they see these new settlers, Brutus and Corineus and his buddies, and they say, no, we're not going to have this. You killed a bunch of people. We're going to get rid of you. So they come down. They start wasting these guys left and right. And the Trojans, though, manage to rally back, and they kill all the giants except for one detestable monster named Gogmagog, who in stature was said to have stood 12 cubits high and possessing of such prodigious strength that at one shake he pulled up an oak as if it had been a hazel wand. He is captured so that Corineus can wrestle with him for sport. A giant breaks three of Corineus's ribs, which so enrages him that he picks up the giant and carries him on his shoulders to the top of a high rock, from which he throws the giant down into the sea. Where he fell would later be known as Gogmagog's Leap to posterity. Now, according to this story, Gogmagog and his fellow giants attempted to wipe out these Trojans. These invading colonizers are told when they arrive that the land is inhabited by only giants, and that the giants are but few. They're at this time almost gone. So this leaves, that this is the time the goddess Diana descends and tells them the giants have killed each other off. There's not very many of them left. Go wipe them out. And they do. And this is where Gog Magog comes in. But he becomes immortalized as a guardian. But why is he immortalized as a guardian? Well, because he was originally in this story, he was the greatest of all the giants that was in Albion, the land that Brutus and his men would later call England. But is that the only reason that he is immortalized? Is it because he's the last? Is it because he was the last sort of line of resistance to this new invasion? Well, maybe. Or maybe it has something to do with Gog's name. Maybe it has something to do with the ancient origins of his name. You see, Gog Magog is a name that's actually been heavily debated amongst English scholars. The name Gog Magog is often connected to the biblical characters Gog and Magog, despite the fact that an author, Manly Pope, who was an author of an 1862 translation of the Welsh Chronicle, which itself is a translation of Monmouth's Historia Regum Britanniae, argued it is a corruption of Gower Madoc, or Madoc the Great. And maybe that's the case. Maybe it's a corruption of Madoc the Great. But if that's the case, the most notable Madoc that we know of was according to Welsh folklore, is a Welsh prince who sailed to America in 1170, over 300 years before Christopher Columbus's voyage in 1492. And while this is a popular story, that he founded a kingdom with the Indians, it doesn't really add up to giants. It's kind of hard for Madoc the Great to be a giant if it's not even mentioned in his story that he's a giant. Take a look at the more ancient source material, and perhaps we'll learn a little bit more about Gog Magog by looking at the more ancient origins of his name. The name Gog and Magog are actually mentioned in the book of Ezekiel a number of times. But in the 38th chapter of Ezekiel, they're also mentioned in Numbers, but in the 38th chapter of Ezekiel, which are these visions that the prophet Ezekiel is being given by God that prophesy the future and the end times, right? The spooky stuff within Christianity. And keep in mind, we're going to get to some of the other ancient texts as well, but I want to keep with this. They are mentioned 38 of Ezekiel, verse 2. And it says, "Son of man, set your face against Gog of the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. Prophesy against him. And say, this is what the sovereign Lord says. I am against you, Gog, chief prince of Meshech and Tubal." Now, in Ezekiel, we're learning, we'll see here that Gog and Magog are referred to as enemies of the people, the chosen people, right? It says, I will turn, in the fourth verse, it says, I will turn you around, put hooks in your jaws, and bring you out with your whole army, your horses, your horsemen, fully armed, and a great horde with large and small shields, all of them brandishing their swords. And it speaks of a great battle with these individuals. So this is one of the major and Magog. But what other references do we have? Well, we have the book of Revelation, chapter 20 in the book of Revelation also mentions Gog and Magog. See, they are quite popular. So we look at 7 we hear the judgment. We're in the 20th chapter of Revelation, they talk about the judgment of the accuser or the devil. It says, when 1,000 years are over, Satan will be released from his prison. And then it says in the 8th verse of Revelation, and he will go out to deceive the nations in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, and to gather them for battle. In number, they are like the sand on the seashore. It's a little bit disturbing, disconcerting, one might say. Now, in the Hebrew Bible, Gog and Magog are references to what may be peoples, individuals, or lands, but are also a prophesied enemy nation of God's people, according to the book of Ezekiel and according to Genesis, one of the nations who are descended from the son of Noah. Now, who is Japheth. Now, we do know, according to the book of Enoch and a number of other ancient scripts, that Noah was the survivor of the flood, right? This cataclysmic event that he is warned of, and he alone is warned of, because the people of the earth are wicked, and because, if you read the book of Enoch, the angels and higher entities that served the Christian or Hebrew at this time, God, came down from the heavens and decided to breed with men, creating these entities known as the Nephilim. And the Nephilim are giants. They're the men of great powers. And indeed, David, in the story of David and Goliath, is thought to have fought against a giant. Goliath himself is said to have stood, between 8 and 9 feet tall, depending on which translation of the story you're looking at. That's a pretty big individual. That would be a giant in comparison to the average person, and particularly to David at the time, since he's only a kid, and also since people at that time were predominantly small. Now, the Gog prophecy is meant to be fulfilled at the approach of what is called the end of days, but not necessarily the end of the world. Jewish eschatology viewed Gog and Magog as enemies to be defeated by the returning Messiah, which would usher in an age of the Messiah. Now, Christianity's interpretation of these is more apocalyptic, making Gog and Magog the allies of Satan against God at the end of the millennium, as can be read in the book of Revelation, which I, of course, already did, mentioning the fact that Satan was supposedly going to be released from a prison, and at his side would be Gog and Magog, his allies, who would go out in all the directions of the earth and rule it. Now, a legend is also attached to Gog and Magog by the time of the Roman period that the gates of Alexander were erected by Alexander the Great to repel the tribe. So this is, in this translation, these are references to a tribe of people who were thought to be quite dangerous and in needing of repelling. And remember that Alexander the Great is a legendary figure in and of himself, a historical figure nonetheless, but still quite legendary. A large number of stories are attributed to him. Romanized Jewish historian Josephus knew them as the nation descended from Magog, the Japhethite, as in Genesis, and explained them to be the Scythians. Now, in the hands of early Christian writers, they became apocalyptic hordes, and throughout the medieval period, variously identified as the Huns, the Khazars, Mongols, or other nomads, or even the 10 lost tribes of Israel. So Gog and Magog are peoples being referred to oftentimes, and oftentimes they have very negative connotations, right? Very dangerous. If you don't know who that's, pretty rough and rowdy bunch, okay? They are very well known, but the Scythians, or the Scyth in Indo-Persian, also known as, or in the Indo-Persian context, are referred to as the Saka, are a group of Iranian peoples known as the Eurasian nomads who inhabited the western and central Eurasian steppes from about the 9th century BC until about the 1st century BC. Scythia was the Greek term for the grasslands north and east of the Black Sea. And the languages they spoke belonged to the eastern branch of the Iranian languages. Now, these peoples are among the earliest peoples to master mounted warfare. They kept herds of horses, cattle, and sheep, lived in tent-covered wagons, and fought with bows and arrows on horseback, developing a rich culture characterized by opulent tombs, fine metalwork, and brilliant art style. But they're known predominantly for their ability and prowess in war. They are known for the fact that they conducted some of the most bloody kings and raidings of the ancient world. They were thought to have possibly raided Zhao China in the 8th century. They dislodged the Sumerians from power on the Pontic Steppe, and at their peak came to dominate the entire steppe zone, stretching from the Carpathian Mountains in the west to Central Asia, which predominantly be the central part of China, and the South Siberia, in the east, creating what has been called the first Central Asian nomadic empire, though there was little that could be called an organized state, but nonetheless, they rode through, and essentially, they were probably to be considered some of the most badass people whoever were around. Basically, this tribe of people were people you didn't want to play with. So in this context, Gog and Magog are references to peoples such as the Scythians. But of course, those of you who are even vaguely familiar with history would know the Huns and the Mongols very well. Both, again, nomadic peoples who roamed and waged war, known to have conquered great pieces of territory in their time. The Huns also are, again, one of those roaming peoples who fought war on were very effective in comparison to their enemies and caused the disintegration and the destruction of entire empires in their wake. So Gog and Magog can seemingly refer to warriors so devastating that they bring about the end of civilizations. These terms, Gog and Magog, might be alternatively translated, even though not translated specifically from the language that they come from, but might be alternatively interpreted as the bringers of destruction, those who bring about the end of civilization. The legend of Gog and Magog and the gates was also interpolated into the Alexander Romance. In one version, Goth and Magoth are kings of the unclean nations driven beyond a mountain pass by Alexander and blocked from returning by his new wall. Gog and Magog are said to engage in human cannibalism in the Roman romances and derived literature, and they have also been depicted on medieval cosmological maps, sometimes along Alexander's wall. Now, before we continue and look at how Gog and Magog are interpreted by the Quran and other various texts, we're going to take a short commercial break. And it's at this time I'd like to remind you all that we do have a proud new sponsor here at Totally Driven Entertainment. He's wacky, he's funny, and he's crazy. Check out ChrisFraleyPresents.com for, some good laughs, quality entertainment. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about the terms Gog and Magog in the context of the Quran and other early texts, and perhaps we'll have a better understanding of Gog Magog as well.
I am black man, saving man's eyes, one stereotype at a time.
To the black barber. To the corner of Martin Luther King Street and Malcolm X Boulevard, pronto.
Will black man make it to the crime on time? Or will he be on CPT? Stay tuned at ChrisFraleyPresents.com.
Attention business owners, website owners, event promoters, or anyone looking to promote your product. The Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network is a perfect way to spread the word of your business around the world. That's right. You can advertise at our network and be played on all of our shows at rates that are so cheap, it's a no-brainer. For more information, contact Bay Ragney at bayragney@gmail.com. To keep your business driven, stay driven with Totally Driven Entertainment.
Are you a fan of Sherlock Holmes? Letters from Holmes offers unique, one-of-a-kind letters from the world-famous detective himself. Handwritten on 8.5-inch by 11-inch aged parchment paper and using smudge-free ink to produce original, high-quality letters that fans will treasure for years to come. Each letter is handcrafted and written from the perspective of Sherlock Holmes, mimicking Holmes's native tongue and embracing many of the famous detective's quirks, quips, insults, and peculiarities. Order a love letter, birthday greeting, personal correspondence, or more only at www.etsy.com/shop/lettersfromholmes.
For $5 today, you can buy a wealth of things. Gas for your car, rent a movie for the family, a few slices of pizza. $5 still takes you a long ways. But did you know that $5 can buy your child a bag of heroin in the streets? That's right. For only $5, your son or daughter can buy some of the cheapest and purest dope in the country. Be aware of the lies. Be aware of the stealing. Be aware that's all it takes to kill your child. $5. This message was brought to you by Casey's Cause, a group of parents located in southern Chester County out to save your child's life. Come join us today at www.caseyscause.com. And remember, $5 is all it takes. Casey's Cause, www.caseyscause.com.
Looking for that perfect gift for your girlfriend? Then look no further than Teddy Scares. Teddy Scares are available in a variety of styles, sizes, and prices for all your shopping needs. Teddy Scares are a mix of cute and creepy to make a great gift for almost any age. Board up your windows, lock your doors, and log on to TeddyScares.com. And be sure to become our friends at Facebook.com/TeddyScares.
Calling all comic book fans. Do you collect comics? Did you ever collect comics? Do you think your children might like reading comic books? Do you even know they still print real, paper, non-digital comic books? Well, then visit the Pirates of Ontario Street Comics in Philadelphia. We have a massive collection of comic books, action figures, trading cards, and much more. We have one of the largest stocks of back-issue comics in the area. We bag and board every new comic book at no extra charge. Our store is voted the best comic book shop in the 2013 PHL 17 Hot List Contest. Part of the movie Unbreakable is filmed in our store. We are open 7 days a week. Ontario Street Comics is located at 2235 East Ontario Street in the Port Richmond section of Philly. Our phone number is 215-288-7338. Type in the words Ontario Comics Philadelphia to check out our wacky stores page on Facebook.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Bareback Facts. Hope you guys enjoyed the commercial break. Now, before we went to break, we talked about some of the various peoples who have been identified with the term Gog and Magog and some of the more ancient references to this name. But now we'll get to some other cultural looks at these words. Gog and Magog appear in the Quran as Yajuj and Majuj, adversaries of Dhul-Qarnayn, a legendary figure derived from Alexander the Great. Muslim geographers identified them at first with Turkic tribes from Central Asia and later with the Mongols. Now, in modern times, they remain associated with apocalyptic thinking, especially in the U.S. and the Muslim world. Today, the terms Gog and Magog are still seen as apocalyptic references. The first mention of the two names occurs in the book of Ezekiel, where Gog is an individual and Magog is his land. In Genesis 10, Magog is a person and the son of Japheth, son of Noah, but no Gog is mentioned. And then again, I mentioned again in Revelation, Gog and Magog together are the hostile nations of the world. Gog the Reubenite occurs in Chronicles chapter 1, but appears to have no connection with Gog of Ezekiel or Magog of Genesis. Let's take a look at Chronicles and see what it says. And before and after that, we'll take a look at some of the other textual references to Gog and Magog. But in Chronicles, we see in First Chronicles chapter 7, know, the guys, this is not meant to be like a Bible lesson. This is just a look at the terms and where they come from. So know that, because and I also want to point out that just because a text is religious doesn't mean it doesn't provide some historical foundations for us to use, because some people do exist in these ancient texts. The Assyrians are obviously real. So are the Akkadians and the various peoples mentioned by the Quran and the Bible and the Torah are actual people. These people, some of these peoples actually existed. Now, in the fifth chapter of Chronicles, when it's talking about the various families, the descendants of Joel, Shemaiah his son, Gog his son, and Shimei his son. So this is looking at some of the various tribes and their families and who's descended from who, and yet Gog's name is sort of name dropped and not mentioned again. The form Gog and Magog may have emerged as shorthand for Gog and of the land of Magog based on their usage in the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible. An example of this combined form in Hebrew, Gog Umagog, has been found, but its context is unclear, being preserved only in a fragment of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now remember that part of the Dead Sea Scrolls contains pieces of the Book of Enoch, which refers to the Nephilim, these giants who were the offspring of angels and men. The meaning of the name Gog remains uncertain, and is, in any case, the author of the Ezekiel prophecy seems to attach no particular importance to it specifically, though efforts have been made to identify him with various individuals, notably Gyges, a king of Lydia in the early 7th century BC, but many scholars don't believe he's related to any historical person. The name Magog is equally obscure, but may come from the Assyrian Matgu-Yu, land of Gyges, i.e. Lydia. Alternatively, Gog may be derived from Magog rather than the other way around, and Magog may be code for Babylon. Still, the biblical Gog and Magog possibly gave derivation of the name Gog Magog, which we're talking about right now, and later corrupted folk rendition print altered the tradition around Gog Magog and Quirinius with two giants, Gog and Magog, with whom the Guildhall statues we're talking about today came to be identified. Now, remember that that these books tell us a good deal about what people are thinking about and what they're talking about and what they believe at the time when they're writing. But remember that the Bible, parts of the Bible, parts of the Torah, parts of the Quran, they're written during chaotic times. History is full of times ruled by chaos, especially the Bible, in which there's constant warring between various tribes and various ancient kingdoms vying for control of entire regions. And you need only look at the Greeks, the Babylonians, the Romans later, to see that all these empires are giving way to new empires, right? Now, after the failure of anti-Roman Bar Kokhba revolt in the 2nd century AD, which looked to a human leader as the promised Messiah, Jews began to conceive of the Messianic age in supernatural terms. First came a forerunner, the Messiah Ben Joseph, who would defeat Israel's enemies, identified as Gog and Magog. Again, Gog and Magog's names continue to pop up. But let's take a look at some of the others. The first century Jewish historian Josephus identified the Gog and Magog as Scythians, horse-riding barbarians from around the Don and the Sea of Azov. Josephus recounts the tradition that Gog and Magog were locked up by Alexander the Great behind iron gates in the Caspian Mountains, generally identified with the Caucasus Mountains. This legend must have been current in contemporary Jewish circles by this period, coinciding with the beginning of the Christian era. Now, several centuries later, the material was vastly elaborated in the Apocalypse of Pseudo-Methodius and Alexander Romance. Now, in the Syriac Alexander legend dating to between 629 and 630, Gog and Magog appear as kings of Hunnish nations And this is written by a Christian based in Mesopotamia. The legend is considered the first work to connect the gates with the idea that Gog and Magog are destined to play a role in the apocalypse. The legend claims that Alexander carved prophecies on the face of the gate, marking a date for when these Huns, consisting of 24 nations, will breach the gate and subjugate the greater part of the world. Now, the Pseudo-Methodius, which comes out in the 7th century, is the first source in the Christian tradition for a new element, two mountains moving together to narrow the corridor, which was then sealed with a gate against Gog and Magog. The idea is also in the Quran, and it found its way into the Western Alexander Romance. Now, in the Alexander Romances, this Gog and Magog legend is not found in the earlier versions of the Alexander Romance of Pseudo-Castellanese, whose oldest manuscript dates to the 3rd century, but this is an interpolation into recensions around the 8th century. And in the latest and longest Greek version are described as the unclean nations, which include the Goth and Magoth as their kings, and whose people engage in the habit of eating worms, dogs, human cadaver, and fetuses, and they are allied to the Belsirians, Bebriks of Bithynia in what is now modern-day North Turkey, and sealed beyond the breasts of the north, a pair of mountains 50 days march towards the north. Gog and Magog appear in somewhat later Old French versions of the romance as well in the verse Roman de Alexander, branch 3 of Lambert El Tor, written in 1170. Gog and Magog, Goths et Margos, Go et Margo, were vassals to Porus, king of India, providing an auxiliary force of 400,000 men. Routed by Alexander, they escaped through a defile in the mountains of Tus or Tours, and are sealed by the wall erected there to last until the advent of the Antichrist. Now, branch 4 of the poetic cycle tells that the task of guarding Gog and Magog, as well as the rule of Syria and Persia, were assigned to Antigonus, one of Alexander's successors. Gog and Magog also appear in Thomas de Kent's Roman de Tocchevalerie, written in 1180, where they are portrayed as cave dwellers who consume the flesh of humans. In the 13th century French Roman d'Alexandre en Prose, Alexander has an encounter with cannibals who have taken over the role of Gog and Magog, and this is the case a case of imperfect transmission, since the prose Alexander's source manuscripts. Now, Gog and Magog are not only human flesh eaters, but illustrated as men, notably beaked nose, in examples such as Henry of Mainz. Gog and Magog characterized as figures with hooked noses on miniature, depicting their attack on the Holy City, is found in a manuscript of the Apocalypse in Anglo-Norman. Now, they're also identified with a number of civilizations, as I mentioned earlier. Early Christian writers, Eusebius, frequently identified Gog and Magog with the Romans and their emperor. Oddly enough, surprise, they're going to throw it on the people they hate. After the empire became Christian, Ambrose, the early Christian writer, identified Gog with the Goths, which of course they did, because who were the Romans at constant war with and strife with? The Goths. Later, Christian writer Jerome, and the Jordanes, who again the Romans are fighting, said that the Goths, Scythians, and Amazons were all the same. He also cited Alexander's gates in the Caucasus Mountains. And then the Byzantine writer Procopius said it was the Huns Alexander had locked out. And a Western monk named Fredegar seems to have Gog and Magog in mind in his description of savage hordes from beyond Alexander's gates who had assisted the Byzantine emperor Heraclius against the Saracens. So, again, they continue to seemingly be identified with people that Abrahamic religious groups hate. One nomadic people followed another on the Eurasian steppes, so that the identification as one nomadic people followed another on the Eurasian steppes, so the identification of Gog and Magog shifted. So as these different nomadic groups started moving around and migrating into Western Europe and into what we now denote as the Middle East, from the Asian steppes and from Southeast, well, not Central Asia is more like it. I mean, very little from Southeast Asia, but from Central Asia and the Eurasian steppes, the name ships. In the 9th and 10th centuries, these kingdoms were identified by some with the lands of the Khazars, who are Turkic people who had converted to Judaism and whose empire dominated Central Asia. The 9th century monk Christian of Stavelot, referred to Ghazari, said of the Khazars that they were living in the lands of Gog and Magog, and noted that they were circumcised, observing all the laws of Judaism. Arab traveler Ibn Fawlan also reported of his belief, writing around the year 921. He recorded that some hold the opinion that Gog and Magog are the Khazars. So these people are different than us. Obviously, they're the evil people we were reading about that are going to come destroy us. Then after the Khazars come the Mongols, seen as mysterious and invincible horde from the east, who destroyed Muslim empires and kingdoms in the early 13th century. Kings and popes took them for their legendary Prester John, marching to save Christians from the Saracens. But when they encountered Poland and Hungary, and annihilated Christian armies, a terrified Europe concluded that they were the Magogali, the offspring of Gog and Magog, released from the prison Alexander had constructed for them and heralding Armageddon itself. Europeans in medieval China reported findings from their travels to the Mongol Empire. Some accounts and maps began to place the Caspian Mountains and Gog and Magog just outside the Great Wall of China. The Tartar relation, an obscure account of Friar Carpini's 1240s journey to Mongolia, is unique in alleging that these Caspian Mountains in Mongolia, where the Jews called Gog and Magog by their fellow countrymen, are said to have been shut in by Alexander. Moreover, purported by the Tartars to be magnetic, causing all iron equipment and weapons to fly towards the mountains on approach. In the year 1251, the French friar André de Longjume informed his king that the Mongols originated from a desert further east, and an apocalyptic Gog and Magog, Got and Margoth people, dwelled further beyond, confined by the mountains. In fact, Gog and Magog were held by the Mongol to be their ancestors, at least by some segment of the population, as traveler and friar Ricoldo da Monte di Croce put it in the year 1291. They say themselves that they are descended from Gog and Magog, and on this account they are called Magoli, as if from a corruption of Magagoli. Marco Polo, traveling when the initial terror had subsided, places Gog and Magog among the Tartars and Tenduk, but then claims that the names Gog and Magog are translations of the place names Ung and Mungul, inhabited by the Ung and Mongols respectively. An explanation offered by Orientalist Henry Yule was that Marco Polo was only referring to the rampart of Gog and Magog, a name from the Great Wall of China. Friar Andre's placement of Gog and Magog far east of Mongolia has been similarly explained. Now, oddly enough, in modern apocalypticism, which is the now modern discussions of the apocalypse and, you know, the Armageddon that everybody claims is always going to happen. It's always going to happen. Every generation has an Armageddon. Everybody is just so hell-bent that they're going to predict the end of the world. Everybody's got to have their hand in it. And in more modern times, Russia has been referred to as Gog and Magog, oddly enough. So we see that in the Hebrew and Christian tradition, Gog and Magog tend to be references to those that we see as a threat to our place in the world and our civilization. This continues. Now, and I want to get through this fairly quickly, but in the Muslim tradition, the conflation of Gog and Magog with the legend of Alexander and the Iron Gates was disseminated throughout the Near East in the early centuries of the Christian era. In the Quran, Surah 18, Yajuj and Majuj, Gog and Magog, are suppressed by Dhul-Qarnan, the two-horned one, a legendary figure derived from Alexander the Great. having journeyed to the ends of the world, meets a people who scarcely understood a word, who seek his help in building a barrier that will separate them from the people of Yajuj and Majuj, who do great mischief on earth. He agrees to build it for them, but warns when the time comes, the last age, Allah will move the barrier, and Yajuj and Majuj will swarm through and destroy everybody. Now, in the early Muslim traditions, which was summarized by Zarqiyya al-Qazwini in 1283, in two popular works called The Cosmography and The Geography, Gog and Magog, he says, live near to the sea that encircles the earth and can be counted only by God. They are only half the height of a normal man, with claws instead of nails and a hairy tail and huge hairy ears, which they use as mattress and cover for sleeping. They scratch at their wall each day until they almost break through, and each night God restores it. But when they do break through, they will be so numerous that their vanguard is in Syria and their rear is in Khorasan. Which is quite the distance. Various nations and peoples in history were identified with Gog and Magog. At one point, it was the Turks who threatened Baghdad and northern Iran. Later, when the Mongols destroyed Baghdad in 1258, they who were Gog and Magog and the wall dividing them from civilized peoples was normally placed towards Armenia and Azerbaijan. But in the year 842, the Caliph al-Wasiq had a dream in which he saw that it had been breached and sent an official named Salam to investigate. He returned a little over 2 years later and reported that he had seen the wall and also the tower where Zulkarnain had left his building equipment, and all was still intact. It's not entirely clear what he saw, but he may have reached the Jade Gate, the westernmost customs point of the border of China. Somewhat later, the 14th century traveler Ibn Battuta reported that the wall was 60 days travel from the city of Zaitun, which is on the coast of China. The translator notes that Ibn Battuta has confused the Great Wall of China with that of being built of a wall being built by Dhul-Qarnayn. In the early 19th century, some Chassidic rabbis identified Napoleon's invasion of Russia as the War of Gog and Magog. Again, you see people referring to their enemies as Gog and Magog based on their holy texts, in this case, the Torah. But as the century progressed, apocalyptic expectations receded as the populace in Europe began to adopt an increasingly secular worldview. This has not been the case in the U.S., where a 2002 poll indicated that 59% of Americans believe that the events predicted in the Book of Revelation will come to pass. During the Cold War, the idea that Russia had the role of Gog gained popularity, since Ezekiel's words described him as having a prince of Meshech. Rosh Meshech in Hebrew sounded suspiciously like Russia and Moscow. Some Russians took up the idea, apparently unconcerned by the implications. Ancestors were found in the Bible, and that was enough, as did Ronald Reagan, because of course he did. Anything right, Reagan? Some post-world Cold War millenarians still identify Gog with Russia, but they now tend to stress its allies among Islamic nations, particularly Iran. For the most fervent, the countdown to Armageddon began with the return of the Jews to Israel, followed by further signs pointing to the nearness of the final battle, nuclear weapons, European integration, Israel's seizure of Jerusalem, and America's wars in Afghanistan and the Persian Gulf. In the prelude to the 2003 invasion of Iraq, George W. Bush told Jacques Chirac, Gog and Magog are at work in the Middle East. This confrontation, he urged the French leader, is willed by God, who wants to use this conflict to erase his people's enemies before a new age begins. Chirac had to consult a professor at the Faculty of Theology of the University of Lausanne to explain Bush's reference. In the Islamic apocalyptic tradition, the end of the world would be preceded by the release of Gog and Magog, whose destruction by God in a single night would usher in the day of resurrection. So not so bad in the Islamic context. It's over in a night. Reinterpretation did not generally continue after classical times, but the needs of the modern world would have produced a new body of apocalyptic literature in which Gog and Magog are identified as the Jews and Israel, or the Ten Lost Tribes, or sometimes as communist Russia and China. Main problem that many people have, at least in contemporary times, is identifying the barrier holding them back, which has not been found in the modern world. The answer varies, some writers saying that they were the Mongols, and others, now that the wall is gone, others that both the wall and Magog are invisible. Gog and Magog are invisible. So there you go, guys. You have invisible guys potentially invisible enemies that will destroy you. So what does this tell us about Gog Magog? Well, it tells us a great deal. It tells us that the names Gog and Magog, and even the conflation of the name Gog Magog, goes back thousands of years, and that it's no coincidence that the British that the English are telling stories about Gog and Magog as their adversaries, particularly in a story, a folk legend about the foundation of Britain by a Trojan king. It's no surprise that Gog and Magog make a return. They've been the ancient enemy of the quote-unquote civilized nations for thousands of years. For a millennia, the names Gog and Magog in many forms have terrified various groups, whether they be Christian, Muslim, Jewish, or even pagan, for that matter. In the case of the Romans, in many cases, were in fact pagan. Not all the time, some of them Christian, but many of them were pagan, and still the term Gog and Magog persists, including and notwithstanding even with amongst the Mongols and the Chinese even. So the term has been tossed around for ages. And it's no surprise that it reaches as far as England, because or that it reaches as far as China, with the great amount of upheaval that these parts of the world have experienced over the course of a millennia. So what does this tell us about Gog Magog's story? It tells us that it's got great, rich historical roots that can be found in multiple theologies, whether it be the Abrahamic religions, whether it be the legend of Alexander the Great and his heroic deeds penned by Greeks and Romans and Persians and Mongols and all over the place. Alexander was well known. Whoever's penning the story, whether it's the French, whether it's the Italians, whether it's the Syrians, Gog and Magog remain fixture as villains. Villains in a story as old as time. It's a tale as old as time, guys. It's better than Beauty and the Beast, because in this scenario, our enemy can literally be anyone. So, guys, I hope you've enjoyed this trip through multiple theologies, multiple historical perspectives, and all through the lens of one legend. I bet you guys didn't think we could wrap it all up with a pretty bow like that, but I can, I did, and guys, that's all I've got for you today. If you guys are interested and you happen to be in London, go check out the Guardian statues at Guildhall in London. But if you're interested in just listening or reading the story of Gog Magog, check out Geoffrey Monmouth's Historia Regum Brittany, or The History of the Kings of Britain. It's been penned many times. There's many, many translations of the story. You can look at Pope Manley's edition, History of the Kings of Ancient Britain, from Brutus to Cato Willard, The Chronicle of the Early, and you can look at The Giants of the Island by Richard Barber, The Giants of the Island of Albion. You can also look at Robert Hunt's The Giants, Corineus, and Gog Magog as well. And if you're really looking to spice it up, take a look at Walter Stevens' Giants in Those Days, Folklore, Ancient History, and Nationalism. A nice segue into looking at the multiple perspectives of not only the story of Gog Magog and the story of Brutus of Troy and Corineus and their foundation of Britain, but also how these folk tales can really be a major driving force for nationalism and tying people together with pride in their nation. So, guys, that's all I've got for you today. I hope you enjoyed the show. Check out my latest book, Iscariot Song, on Amazon, and I'll see you guys all next week. And, of course, on Sunday with Straight Football Talk. Don't forget to catch me there at 9 a.m. Eastern time. Enjoy the rest of your day, guys. Enjoy the rest of your week. See you all very soon.